right, ladies and gentlemen from around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Salts, Mongoloozy, and Bendesky Hour here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a phenomenal show, very serious topic, and some fantastic lawyers to really discuss it. We have Kristen Fedden. How are you?
Great. How are you?
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
It's my pleasure, no question. Elizabeth Bailey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. And Marnie Berger, how are you?
Doing well. Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you all here. What I'd like to do is start off a little bit with each one of you and tell me a little bit and our listeners a little bit about yourself. Kristen Fedden, if you would.
Absolutely. My name is Kristen Fedden, as you know. I've been practicing in the sex abuse litigation arena for over a decade now. I started off my legal career as a law clerk for a judge, and then I quickly went into prosecution where I was a sex crimes prosecutor. One of my most notable cases was the case of Commonwealth v. Bill Cosby. I prosecuted both of those cases. And then I jumped into the defense realm where I did insurance kind of litigation, but not in the insurance realm. I did more Title IX investigations. And then I joined Salts, Mongoloozy, and Bendesky, where along with Marnie and Liz Bailey, we run the sex abuse practice group.
All right.
But my favorite job is being a mother of two beautiful boys.
That's what I'm talking about right there. Well said. Well said. Liz, if you would.
Yeah. So I started at Salts, Mongoloozy, 5 years ago now. And I started my legal career doing defense work. When I came over here, I really was doing construction and workplace litigation, which I still makes up a large part of my practice. But I've been able to translate the trial work and the litigation work that I've really made my bones on and come over and do sex assault and sex abuse work with Chrissy, which I don't want to say a passion project, but I love doing this work and I love being able to be there for victims in really difficult times and learn a lot from Chrissy and Marnie and really be able to be there for victims in a way that, is a little bit different than the construction and the workplace litigation.
And we're gonna talk about all that. Marnie, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So both like Kristen and like Liz, I've had several different experiences before joining the firm, and I do feel I'm at the place I'm meant to be and practicing the type of work that is the most rewarding for sure. My background is in insurance litigation. I represented insurance companies prior to the start of the pandemic, and I came over here to the firm in July of 2020 to spearhead our insurance recovery initiatives. And I still do that, and that's still a large role at the firm, but I do incorporate that into my sex abuse practice, which is about 70%, a large part of my caseload today.
And I imagine since the three years came on, you've been carrying this firm on your back and you could use some help. Finally. Oh, I'm just kidding. Having said that, one word to describe each, if you had one word to describe yourselves individually to your clients, what would it be, Kristen?
Committed.
Relentless.
Zealous.
All right. Those are three good words. So today's topic, we're going to talk about civil justice and sexual assault cases, okay? But Salts, Mongoloozy, Bendesky, I mean, obviously there's a wide array of personal injury type cases that is handled. I want the listeners to understand that, because we're going to dominate the show with this very serious topic. Kristen, could you kind of lay that out, if you would? What other types of, now I know it's so, it's so vast, but give me a brief overview of what other case types of personal injury cases the firm represents.
The firm is a premier litigation firm. We handle all types of personal injury matters from motor vehicle accidents all the way up to, as you mentioned, sex abuse. We also handle civil rights violations. And we also handle construction litigation, railroad accidents, and incidents where the victim is in a catastrophic injury type state.
So we and medical malpractice
medical
as well.
Medical malpractice
toxic
as well.
Torts.
Yeah. Mass torts, right.
I'll be honest with you. I would say we would do any case where you need a trial attorney, right? I mean, I think about the defamation case with Amber Heard and Johnny Depp, and I'm not trying to have that conversation about how anybody feels about that, but we are trial attorneys. We can try any case where there's a victim or an injured person or anyone that needs some kind of civil justice. That's what we
Absolutely.
Do.
And having the vast resources like the firm has is so important. Amazingly, you know, a lot of clients, individuals who are catastrophically injured, and you know, that may be the only time in their life, God forbid, it happens to them. They can't make a mistake. And one of the most important parts of retaining the right firm and the right attorneys is that firm and those attorneys having the resources to fight at the highest level and not have to worry about not being able to hire an investigator, Liz.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that you get with a premier firm like ours is you get the resources, not only the wealth of knowledge of all of our attorneys and sort of all of our collective hive mind, but also you don't have to worry about coming out of pocket to pay for your case. We take care of everything. We pay all the case costs up front, pay for investigators, pay for private eyes to do background checks, to do social media sweeps, to do the things you need to do for a perpetrator surveillance, things like that. And that's not something you ever have to think about. We handle that. We pay for costs. And then if there is a recovery, that comes out at the end.
And maximizing recovery, I think, something that is so important that I think our firm really excels at. I handle insurance bad faith cases. And that's one way we have been able to maximize recoveries of cases.
And what is that? What is it?
When the insurance company is wrongfully denying a claim. Now, oftentimes our clients can't file those claims directly against the carriers because they don't have a contractual relationship with the insurance company. But one means of settlement we sometimes explore is the defendant actually assigning their rights to us so that we can stand in the policyholder's shoes and then go after the insurance company directly.
Does that happen a lot?
It happens a fair amount, not a ton, but we do set up our cases to make sure that the other side knows that's a possibility and that we mean business.
Sure. So David versus Goliath is not, the one thing I love about this firm is, you know, it's not David versus Goliath. And, you know, normally you walk in, you see the, you know, the TV show with the one attorney there and the five suits on the other side. This firm here, and we've talked about it on a lot of different shows, has the resources at the highest level to be able to represent your clients at the max. And what's important about that is a lot of times, like I said, the clients don't always know. Obviously, you guys get, you know, cases come in here from other law firms, which is a big part of, you know what you guys do here. That means that your reputation to other firms who may be good firms, but know they don't have the resources, they send them here. So that's an awesome thing, and clients should know that. But, you know, obviously, when you're seeking you know, representation for, you know, a case. Having said that, the topic for today's show is a really serious one. And that topic is civil justice and sexual assault cases. What is that? And I ask that question because I'm of the understanding as a layman that a sexual assault case is a criminal case. Okay, what is the civil part and how does that work, Kristen?
So it differs per client. Justice is defined in the way that the client wants justice defined. But one of the beautiful things about our sexual practice litigation group is we don't just attorney. We walk that line, that journey with the client. So however the client wants things to end or how recovery wants to look like for them, that's exactly the line that we take. And that's the journey that we take. So civil justice for some of our clients can be maximal recovery, which is something we are really good at doing. But it can also mean a silent recovery, a pre-litigation demand letter, or something where we resolve the claims with a maximal recovery with confidentiality. So it really depends on what the client is looking for. But it is very different than criminal litigation, I can tell you from being a prosecutor and actually litigating those cases in the criminal courts. The burden is much lower. There's a lot of legal differences. But I think one of the major things that for the clients to kind of know is that the civil justice system kind of looks at it in a different way. It can be very invasive. Yes, there can be depositions. There can be a lot of, you know, things that the client may not want to go through. But the beauty about it in the civil justice realm is, again, we can walk that journey with you. We can try to protect you in many ways that a prosecutor cannot, because a prosecutor represents the Commonwealth. In the civil justice realm, we represent the client.
And having said that, on a basic, you know, if somebody's trying to, you know, visualize it, O.J. Simpson won his criminal case, but he lost his civil case, right? And that's where they, and that's where damages came in. The burden of proof was a little bit, it was what, 51-49?
Significantly lower. And that's the benefit of the civil justice system, is that all you have to do is show, you know, it's one grain of sand more than 50% in the civil justice system. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the criminal justice system. And so the civil justice system, you have a much lower burden of proof to show that something, you know, that this thing happened to you. And so that's the realm that we walk, because what we're talking about is monetary compensation as opposed to putting someone away, putting someone away. You've got that beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Now, does the civil case typically follow the criminal case?
It can, but then keep in mind, many survivors do not want law enforcement involved for whatever reasons, for personal reasons. And so many times we file civil litigation cases with no parallel criminal action. But it really depends, because there's a number of factors that really go into when and why we file on the civil litigation realm.
And in addition to the financial compensation that we always seek for our clients, oftentimes it's just setting things straight with that they're really interested in. So when we have a large institutional defendant, for example, they want the policies changed by and large to better that institution for everybody, so that these things don't happen again.
Well, change happens in the courtroom, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I say this every time I hear a truck outside my house and it's beeping and beeping and beeping and beeping, right?
That's right.
And automatically, I know that happened in a courtroom, and it probably happened because somebody, you know, something bad happened to somebody, and a lawyer took that case and represented a client, and therefore the change, and now you hear that type of situation. This is a different, obviously, scenario, but your point's well taken.
But, you know, prosecutors have a lot of internal discretion about whether to even bring a claim, right? So sometimes prosecutors will decide not to pursue a criminal case for whatever reason. I mean, it's all internal. So with civil cases, the client's really in the driver's seat about whether to proceed with a case in a way that they may not be with a criminal action.
That's right.
Now, does that impact a case if there is no criminal, especially, you know, sexual abuse case, if there's no criminal prosecution, if the victim decides not to pursue the criminal case, but decides to move forward with the civil case, does that impact the case one way or the other? I mean, you've heard, and we're going to get into that, you know, the football player who's gone through this, you know, they always bring up, oh, you're going after the money and stuff like that, and they ignore a lot of the, does that impact the case normally or no?
It doesn't impact it from a resolution standpoint. Absolutely not. Now, will the defense ask, you know, invasive, unnecessary, and irrelevant questions? Absolutely. But they're going to do that anyway.
Yeah, no question. Let's talk about civil actions in regards to sexual assault. Okay. Number one, who do you sue? Let's think about the situation. Mm-hmm. Okay. Somebody gets raped in a parking lot. Okay, it's a dark parking lot. The criminal doesn't have any money. In fact, he's going to jail. Okay, who's the negligent party? Number one, and number two, how does that process work?
The negligent party would be whoever maintains and who is supposed to maintain that parking lot. And so we would look into that. Was there adequate lighting? Was there adequate security, depending on the time of day? Does that particular owner know that that is a very criminal, prolific area? And so we look into a number of things, because what that does is it puts that owner on notice of what they should have had and what they didn't, unfortunately, have for our client.
And having said that, ultimately speaking, is it does it become an insurance issue? In other words, is it, you know, you're going after the client, and, you know, do you ever go after the actual perpetrator?
We normally do name the perpetrator as a defendant, oftentimes. You really don't know what potential insurance coverage may be there until you name the person and you figure out what their insurances potentially are. We oftentimes see that defendants will produce only the declarations page, the summary of the coverages. But as an insurance lawyer, I will tell you that even though that's helpful in knowing what the policy limits are, what the potential recovery is against that defendant, it's really necessary for us to obtain the full policy documents. So that's something, by and large, at our firm that I preach very consistently. Let's get as many policies as we can. Let's figure out what coverages are in place. In our world, sometimes there's sexual abuse and molestation policies. There's all types of insurance policies out there, some that cover intentional acts, some that don't. Is there a negligent act at play in conjunction with the intentional act? If you have a shooter, did the wife maybe leave her firearms unlocked? And that's a negligent act. And then the husband came around and shoots with the gun, for example. Things like that. So the way to maximize recovery is really to figure out what the coverages are. And sometimes even knowing who the witnesses are leads us to the coverage.
So in essence, if somebody does not secure a place properly and somebody gets sexually assaulted, it could be a property owner, a business owner, or an insurance company, or an organization. We talk about a criminal case. The criminal cases, when they occur in these types of situations, do they go hand in hand? And I say that because prosecutor Kristen, how cooperative are law enforcement when it comes to a situation like this? Surely they can, they may not be, insensitive to. They're prosecuting a case. Do they go hand in hand, or how's that work?
Yeah, absolutely, they go hand in hand. Because a lot of the investigative work is done by the law enforcement officials, and then sometimes if we have filed litigation, there's certain depositions, as long as they're not under any confidentiality seal, that we can provide to the prosecution to assist them with meeting their burden beyond a reasonable doubt to prosecute that individual.
So they can actually be simultaneous.
Absolutely. And in some cases they are.
Yeah, and sometimes the criminal records are helpful in our cases.
I was going to say that. Yep. Yeah.
That'll help us figure out some of our deposition questioning, for example.
Right.
The witnesses are.
Right. So both of the systems, the criminal system and the civil system, are generally considered in the American system to be in the public forum, right? And so we each benefit from one another because these are supposed to be publicly available. So they get what we get what they get, barring some sort of order from the court.
These are really serious cases, and there's so many different varieties of it, and we're going to kind of talk about that. But personal, you're in this this area, okay? Does it get personal for you? And when it comes to this, obviously, stereotypically, women are the ones assaulted, but not always. So, and we'll talk about, priests and a Catholic church, which I was, I went to Catholic school. So it infuriated us, but but having said that, how personal does it get?
So that's a really good question. And I find that I take all of my client cases really personally.
Sure.
I know that. I have that tendency anyway. And so these are very hard. And I think my biggest struggle with a lot of these is defense counsel's behavior is particularly bad, in the sense that there's still some misbehavior and in the way that defense counsel behaves. So I tend to take them very personally and get very protective of my client, because there can be a lot of aggression, unnecessary aggression, in the way that some defense attorneys handle these cases.
Okay, so these are difficult types of cases. A lot of times, very difficult for people to step forward. Okay, and as great lawyers, okay, you might know the law, and you may be successful and a bulldog in the courtroom and all those things, but this takes a little bit of sensitivity. By the way, every one of your a catastrophically injured person, when they walk in, I've said it a million times, but when that phone rings and you know somebody's coming in that door and there's a loss of life or a construction, you guys have done the biggest construction cases in the world here, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's never really good news. You're never walking in. So sensitivity obviously is part of your day. But this can often be a little different in the fact that there's so much emotional trauma. And many times, especially if it, so let's kind of, you know, go down, you know, some of these, when you look at these sexual abuse cases and you know, the Cosby case, which you prosecuted, Kristen, this is the Sean Watson case. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to get into that ridiculous insanity. You know, but Jerry Sandusky, Harvey Weinstein, and that, you know, all these other guys. But then let's look at the Catholic clergy. You know, the Glenn Mills. You talk about a lot of these with the Boy Scouts. All these organizations.
Yeah.
You know, when where you may have, you know, someone who's been suffering for decades and are afraid to talk about, you know, what you guys do here. In regards to what client expectations, somebody's calling, you know, the sensitivity and the importance to be able to bring somebody in and give them a cocoon because they are in potentially distraught and maybe not even coming, you know, wanting to come out with it. Talk about, you know, what you guys do here at the firm to make that intake tolerable for them.
Well, first and foremost, one of the things that we take to heart is that rape is one of the most underreported incidents or crimes. And that's for a reason. That's because a lot of times when survivors do come forward, they're made to be discredited. They feel shame. They feel guilt, embarrassment. And that's mainly because of the culture has been really bending towards victim blaming and victim shaming. We make it a point to make sure we don't do that. And we make it a point, as Liz alluded to earlier, to make sure the defense counsel, when and if they do that, we react professionally, but it's known. And I think one of the things that really help us to do that is that we're all trauma informed. And not just the attorneys, but we are also make sure that our staff are also trauma informed. And what does that mean? Well, we take classes on compassion fatigue. We make sure that, you know, if we're feeling distressed over one case, that we have a whole community and network of individuals, both staff and attorney related. So I said, Liz, you know what? I can't do this today. Yeah. I need you to handle it. Or Marnie, I need you to handle it today. That's what we do to make sure that our client doesn't feel the distress that he or she is already feeling just by virtue of the fact that, you know, he or she has been victimized. You make a good point. Our survivors, the plaintiffs that we represent, are female and male.
Children and adults.
I was going to say
children
all ages. You beat me to it. Yeah.
That's right.
Some of them not mentally, you know, some of them are in limited capacity. The most vulnerable members of the population.
Right. And that goes all the way from seniors down to children. And as Marnie mentioned, you know, we do have some individuals who have disabilities that, you know, would categorize them to be a chronological age of 8 and some nonverbal victims.
So people are taking advantage of people who obviously can't defend themselves.
Absolutely.
Oftentimes the defendants in our cases are in a position of power, and there's that power dynamic 9 out of 10 times, I would say.
Yeah. And very interesting that you mentioned that, obviously the power and people taking advantage of people at all ages and all situations, and probably that might be the one, I mean, you know, common denominator. Obviously, they have the power over them. Talk about how these types of situations devastate lives and impact someone's life. It may have happened when they're 7 years old, and right now. We'll get into the statutes of limitations fairly soon, but talk about what these types of situations do to a person.
Well, you know, I think what we see commonly is, you know, beyond just like internalizing that, right, and having that sort of reflect back out on everyone, on their personal relationships, their romantic relationships, their family relationships. In the case of students, we see them drop out. We see bad grades. We see people fall behind on the things they want to do.
Drug use,
depression, anxiety. You know, really, it runs the gamut. And it's really difficult because what ends up happening is they internalize that as a failure on themselves, right? Mm-hmm. It's not as if it's like, oh, this is, you know, I had this accident, I lost my arm, and I can reflect it back to the incident. This is something's wrong with me. this happened to me, something's wrong with me that it happened to me, and now I have all these feelings, and that's also my fault.
What makes somebody step forward finally after years? The Me Too movement would be a great example. I would call those individuals absolute heroes to be able to step in the sight of somebody who was incredibly powerful. What do you find is the final straw that makes somebody come through, move forward with a case?
Oftentimes inspiration from reading a newspaper article, seeing other people come forward. It's a very positive development that one case can lead to another case of people coming forward. Oftentimes as well, our clients repress what happens to them, and they sometimes don't even realize fully the depth of what happens until they read something and it triggers a memory.
How do you get somebody to, when they do have the courage to do that, but and you just said it a little while ago, Kristen, when you're dealing with a civil situation, sometimes they have to get deposed, and there's other situations. It may not be, a rosy road. How do you get them through it? How do you, hold their hand and kind of talk to them and let them know that you're going to be there for them? Because like you said, it can be difficult.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important ways to help a client do that is to be fully transparent about what the process involves. One of the things that we really, really hone in to make sure our clients know is what it looks like from start to finish. We are very honest with them about what the discovery phase looks like, what type of invasive questions that are going to be asked. I mean, we just successfully litigated one case where a defense counsel wanted to ask our victim about some consensual sexual acts, which is completely irrelevant to whether or not the perpetrator, who is a different individual, engaged in sexual contact with that person, or whether or not it's rape, all of that's irrelevant. So we tell them, hey, look, this is what could happen. This is what we're going to do to prevent that from happening. It's always a judge's decision, but we are going to be the shoulder that you get to lean on. If, in fact, the rulings don't go your way, or if, in fact, things don't go as we suggest, but we're going to zealously fight for you. And that's what people want.
Yeah, and it's a marathon, not a sprint.
We give the client options as well. So, for example, we presented the option of a protection for abuse order to clients. I let them know what that process would look like. Sometimes they choose to obtain one, sometimes they don't, but at least they know that option is available to them.
Yeah, and to that end too, I mean, the idea of filing as a DOE as opposed to putting your name on when you file a complaint in certain jurisdictions, you can file under your name, and that's a public record, or you have the option of filing as a DOE so that your name is not a matter of public record and people don't know that you have brought a lawsuit. And those are options that we can discuss with clients when they call in to, what measures of privacy are available to them when they bring suit.
Yeah, and individuals, obviously, most people don't understand or know the law. What about confidentiality and the privacy, like you're talking about? Letting them know that it's okay. And by the way, they don't have to worry about the whole world finding out. You mentioned filing as a DOE, but just a conversation. They file in confidence, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And so they, and
unless for some reason they want their name known, but
right. Which we have clients do. There are clients that absolutely want people to know that this happened to them and that they're not ashamed of it. And, that's a statement in and of themselves.
That's right.
But the other thing is, and I say this to clients all the time, we're not used car salesmen. You call us because you want to find out what options are available to you. You can do that. You don't have to worry about us trying to sell you on something you don't want to do, right? So if you just want to talk to us about what happened and what your civil options are and whether this is a good path for you, you can do that without the fear that we're going to pitch you hard on filing a lawsuit you don't want to file.
Right.
That's always an option.
Right.
Men, okay? Somebody who's been sexually abused in one of these, Glenn Mills or Catholic Church. By the way, I love throwing those names around because I want to make them famous, right? And everybody already knows about them. In fact, when the Pope came to Philadelphia being a Catholic, I thought that was the elephant in the room. And he did cover it. Mm-hmm. He did mention what was going on. But having said that, how difficult is it and how percentage-wise, how unlikely are likely men to come forward with these types of situations, or are they much more likely to just never come forward?
Based on statistics, men are less likely to come forward than women. But again, rape, sexual assault, sex abuse is one of the most underreported crimes anyway. So yes, it is very rare for men to come forward. But when they do, the important thing to remember is to welcome them and treat them with humanity, dignity, and respect. We actually represent a number of males who were sexually abused in some capacity, very similar to the Glenn Mills matter, but at Devereaux. And we have a number of actions against Devereaux, and we represent a number of males who were sexually abused by recreational aides or people in position of power that sexually abused or preyed upon males.
And that's an organizational thing, right? In other words, an organization that allowed, somebody to be either hired without a background check or to, you know, didn't secure their students while they were there.
Correct.
What are the typical, if there are typical, standards or conditions of which, that typically happens? In other words, the grounds that are the most likely.
So when I think of our cases, I categorize them, and Chris, you guys both might have some different thoughts as well, but into sort of sections. And we have cases involving prisons where inmates are abused by corrections officers and the like. We have Title IX cases, of course, that we all work on together involving universities where students are sexually abused. And then the church cases, the archdiocese and the like. Then we also have cases like Devereaux that Chrissy mentioned, the behavioral health facilities, and also physician cases oftentimes where we have cases, chiropractors, different types of physicians that are unfortunately taking advantage of their patients. And then cases involving different types of youth abused in organizational or sporting recreational type activities.
And even to add to that, we also have sex abuse cases by law enforcement officials. So again, it's just that dynamic where you have people in positions of power abusing their position to sexually prey on other individuals.
When it's a law enforcement officer, is there a because I assume it's the city, the city of whatever city it is, do they have limits on their a lot of times the city will have limits on how much you could actually sue them for, which, that's a great luxury to have. But are there typically situations like that?
It depends on the state and it depends on what causes of action that we do go under. But what we try to do is make sure that we can kind of avoid any damage caps that may be in place. But it does depend on the jurisdiction. But if we go federal, usually we're good on
right.
damage caps.
Yeah.
Meaning we don't have to follow any damage caps.
That's part of the process at the inception of a case, figuring out the best possible jurisdiction where we're the most likely to succeed.
And the best cause of action to avoid any caps on or immunity issues that we might have.
And that brings me to the resources and experience. What type of luxury is it to have the type of experience you have in this room and at the firm? How many attorneys here?
We are over 40. 40? Yeah, over 40 now.
And so there's almost nothing that everybody hasn't seen. In other words, you walk into that room and you can't 40 attorneys, and to be able to throw situations out there, what type of luxury is that to have these resources and experience right in these walls?
It's a phenomenal resource because it's not only just the expertise that we can tap in, it's also people's networks that we can tap into. So I know a number of prosecutors, so I can assist people, both clients and my colleagues, with having to navigate the criminal justice system. We also have a lot of networks in other firms so that we can kind of partner with people and say, hey, have you seen this issue before? Send over some complaints, because it's not that we don't know that area, but a lot of times we need to prove that that entity knew that they should have put certain safeguards in place, and we can tap into our resources from both our other colleagues as well as our attorney network to kind of say, oh, there was another case that was litigated where the same thing, so they knew that this sex abuse could have occurred, but they didn't even put any safeguards up, and that's why our client was abused.
And it's an all-day-long process. That we have email communications firm-wide amongst our base here. We have attorney meetings every Tuesday, and anytime there's an issue or an item for discussion that is relevant, we discuss it. We're worried about what the value of a case is, what we should be demanding in a case. These things are discussed globally to make sure we're doing the right thing.
And it's interesting you say value of a case, because when we talk about that, we're not talking about how much is my case worth. It's about the almost a holistic approach in saying this, when you're vetting a case, you know, you may, you know, and I, what must be really awesome is the fact that you have such experience, you know, in this firm to make sure that the client, you know, if it's a civil case, no matter what type of case it is, mm-hmm. that you're not going to, you know, that it's, that there's an outcome potential, right. for that client.
Right.
I mean, in other words, if the last thing you want is to be able to, is to have to go, go through, even though you're not, you know, you're not charging out of pocket costs, you know, you're vetting the case, you're hiring an investigator. You don't want to put a client through 2 years worth of litigation,
right. Exactly.
And then the settlement goes into the expenses of the case.
Well, what I say to clients is, you know, my job is to look at your case up front and just tell you whether I can put you in a better position than where I found you. And me taking a case just to pay my expenses doesn't put you in a better position. So yeah, we might, you know, I could look at your case and say, yeah, we might get a settlement for X amount, but if X amount, you know, if the juice isn't worth the squeeze, so to speak, you know, if I wouldn't tell my sister or my cousin, yeah, like, let's tear your life open and let's expose all of your past and all of your information for an amount of money that wouldn't pay my cost, then I'm not going to tell you that.
And what types of expenses can go into these cases?
Well, that's a great question. I mean,
that's just who I am.
We already talked about, you know, investigation, but we also need experts. We'll have experts for damages, for the types of things we talked about that affect our clients. Liability experts are important for institutional cases about the things they should have done to prevent this type of thing from happening. And all of that adds up. You know, when for these types of cases, an expense bill of $100,000 is not uncommon.
And having said that, we'll now talk, you know, kind of like, you know, discuss the contingency fee agreement, okay? We touched on it, but there's no out-of-pocket costs.
Right.
So somebody can walk in here, and typically in the worst, you know, moments of their life, they don't have to worry about paying, you know, such skilled attorneys. That most people, no matter what the personal injury is, especially if it's a catastrophic injury, but really any situation, they may not be working. Mm-hmm. The contingency fee agreement is what?
So the contingency fee agreement is what we do for everybody. And it is an agreement that you are not going to get a bill from us under any circumstances. You will pay a fee if your case is ultimately successful out of the proceeds of any settlement or verdict. And it'll be a percentage of the settlement or verdict, and our case costs will come out of that also. So if it doesn't happen often, and it's, you know, it's pretty rare, but if the case doesn't go our way and ultimately there's no recovery, you never get a bill from us for anything, for costs, for our attorney's fees, anything like that. So the client is protected. There's never going to be a dollar amount that comes out of the client's pocket. All of our costs and fees are only coming out of settlements or verdicts.
So these cases sometimes, you know, last, if you look at every type of case, medical malpractice, yeah, obviously a big construction case, but a sexual assault, civil sexuals, you know, they don't typically settle overnight. Insurance companies, what do they say? You know, they're in the business of collecting premiums, not paying them out, right? And I've done a lot of shows with defense attorneys, and you know, it's, you know, no one, even though I just did one last week where they, you know, talked about a couple cases where they just gave the money away because they thought that they were morally, you know, I don't hear that, those sentiments too often. We've been doing this a while, but having said that,
you can give them my number. You can give me those numbers.
I'll tell you, I'll give you the, you know, after the show, you'll probably go, he's full of crap. having said that, you know, these cases can last a long time. And that means, and it, to me, when I think about the contingency fee agreement, I get goosebumps a little bit, because 2 years, 3 years, sometimes, maybe longer, hopefully shorter, but without, you know, obviously getting paid. You know, like, you know, you guys are almost in a sense partnering with the client. You're paying expenses, doing all these things. And obviously the firm is, the reputation is second to none. So, you know, to say you win more than you lose is the understatement essentially. But having said that, it's still a process. And what do you think? What did you think when you learned about the contingency fee agreement first? Like, in other words, you come out of law school, you're like, what? We don't get paid for 2 years?
But it's an unfair advantage for the client.
I was billing. I came out and did defense work, so I was billing for the first 3 years of my career. So, you know, I was used to issuing my monthly bills, and when I came over, it was a big adjustment. I didn't have to issue bills anymore. But I mean, it makes, so I was built for this work. I love working for clients. It makes sense to me. I could not expect my clients to pay me like an insurance company paid me when I was doing defense work.
And what I meant was it levels the playing
field. It absolutely does.
For a client. Marty, what do you think? Because you've kind of like come this way and, you know, kind of switched sides. What are your thoughts?
I really appreciate it from the case management perspective, because I feel like every single second I spend on a case is for a purpose, to push that ball forward. And in my past life, there were days where, you know, I knew I was evaluated based on what I put on my timesheet.
Probably numbers, right?
And if there wasn't a task at hand, I would maybe be writing a letter or doing something that wasn't absolutely imperative to be doing at that exact moment. And I'd be thinking ahead, but not necessarily for the best possible outcome for that day, for that case. Here, when we come in, every single thing that we're doing is largely time sensitive, and really to achieve a very specific goal.
For a human being.
For our client, and it's rewarding, and there's that relationship every step of the way. So every task at hand, there's the communication with the client. They know we're doing it for a reason, and it serves a purpose.
High-profile cases. Okay, you guys here are familiar with them. Kristen, obviously, you did one of the most high-profile cases in the United States ever with the Bill Cosby case. You were prosecuting in that situation, right?
That's right.
Having said that, what's the difference between a high profile case and versus a less high profile case? There may be no difference in regards to the severity of the crime or whatever, whether it's a civil case or even a criminal case. But how does the ebb and flow go with you know, just the entire experience, comparing the two?
Honestly, having tried a high profile case and several high profile cases, there is absolutely no difference between the amount of lawyering, the amount of time, the amount of effort, and the humanity that you give to the survivors between a high profile case and a case that doesn't get as much prestige. I will say, though, with high profile cases, and for someone who has practiced in the sex abuse arena for over a decade, it is nice to get a victory in a sex abuse case, because what it does is it sends a really strong message to other survivors, kind of talking, going back to your
point
about coming forward. It sends such a great message to survivors that, yes, if someone in a position of power, someone as, you know, high up and beloved as Bill Cosby, if that person sexually abuses you, you will be treated with humanity. You will be treated with respect. You will be able to try to get justice, and people will listen to you. So I think that was the message that was sent. Oh, certainly the conviction ended up being overturned, but I spoke with many survivors post then, some Cosby victims and some victims of sexual assault. And it's really the fact that our office went forward with that case. And that's what we do. We go forward. We tell our survivors, we believe you, we trust you, and we're going to march with you. And that's really, I think, really impactful for a survivor.
And our job doesn't end when at any point, you know, really we for example, I mean, we make sure our clients are set up with the appropriate clinical therapists. Mm-hmm. We had a case that we just set up, students who were assaulted by another student. We set up corrective action plans to make sure they're properly cared for at school. That's not at all related to our litigation. It may never even come up in any capacity in our litigation, but it's helping the clients feel comfortable moving forward with their lives.
Certainly, the Me Too movement and what happened. We did I did a broadcast with the head of SAG-AFTRA in Cal. I forget where they're based out of, but I think it was California. Mm-hmm. And what the courage it took for those individuals to step forward. To your point, Kristen, now, you know, hopefully people see the light and it changes it for other people. You know, the Bill Cosby case, you know, every human being in the world had to be sitting there going, he's guilty as hell, but he'll never, they'll never get him to court or whatever, because there was just a double standard, which we're going to get into. But making it possible for those individuals who have gone through it. Must be a great feeling. I mean, it must, knowing that somebody who goes through something like that, as tragic as that, okay, that scumbag who did that, okay, can no longer just turn the page and walk forward. Change happens in the courtroom, and there are people every day walking around who unfortunately may get assaulted, but now they know that there's at least a chance that they could get justice. Years ago, it was few and far between it happening. So great feeling.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, not only does it change the outlook for survivors, but it also changed the profession, right? So law enforcement, one of the things that we did with Bill Cosby, we do this all the time in our daily lives, Liz and Marnie and I, rape myths. It's also an education to potential jurors, in other words, the public, right? Talking about how, just because someone wears something doesn't mean that that's an invitation for rape,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
It changes the mindset.
Well, and even of law enforcement, for example, you've all heard the nightmare stories of women who have been raped, especially years and years ago when they got to the district or the precinct, they were the ones treated like the criminal, right? Like, what you're doing is changing, lives and standards for so many people that get in these situations. We just blew through the break, by the way. having said that, the celebrity status, the powerful, the rich, is there still a double standard there? Because, I myself, I did about 11 years worth of Catholic school, 1 year of high school. I went somewhere else, right? Having said that, I always wondered how the hell, these guys got transferred to somewhere else. I mean, how do you just transfer somebody to somewhere else and cover it up? Celebrity, power, rich, the whole thing. Was there a double standard? B, is there still a double standard? And can these individuals, look at the Deshaun Watson. Okay, I can't get into that. I don't know all the facts, but how that guy stayed out of jail, he should, I said, based upon, you would think 150, 200 years, something like that. As a layman, I'm reading these things. I don't know all the facts, but usually when some 24 people accuse somebody of something, there's a pattern there. But having said that, is there still a double standard?
There is absolutely still a double standard. Cosby took, almost 12 years to get prosecuted? And look at others who haven't even been prosecuted. Weinstein took how long? Several decades to get prosecuted. Epstein took several decades to get prosecuted. There is absolutely still a double standard, and in my belief, there will always be a double standard so long as there are inequities in our society, so long as women are viewed as less than, or people of certain races or people of color are viewed as less than. Wherever there's oppression, there will always be a double standard, and unfortunately, that is the case with sexual abuse.
Assessing damages. We have about, 10 minutes left maximum. Show is flying. How do you assess damages for somebody who's been through these types of situations?
It can certainly be challenging. We oftentimes turn to objective previous rulings in cases, previous verdicts or judgments in other cases, similar cases, to see how these cases come down. That's obviously not the end-all be-all, but that's an area we look into so we can tell the client this is what has happened in the past in your situation, and this is what's likely to happen in the future based on our experience. In our cases, there's usually elements of touching, of course, and how egregious the touching is, how offensive, and how whether it was repeated or not is oftentimes a factor for us in valuing a case.
How about somebody who may have gotten, sexually assaulted, and it destroyed their life? They went from a college student who had all the promise in the world. Now, here's the graph, right?
Right.
A student all the way through, right here down, obviously. Does that factor in?
Huge, huge.
Yeah.
And that's why we hire experts oftentimes as well. And most of our clients, even before we get involved, are already treating with a clinical psychologist or a therapist to help them handle things, their emotions, because of of how drastically these acts have affected their everyday lives and every aspect of their lives.
And I hate to say it, jurisdiction really matters in these cases, because whether or not a jury believes in the case and believes that this is a compensable damage and compensable injury and how much they value the damage is really heavily jurisdiction based. You guys agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that's beneficial about this firm is that we're trial attorneys.
Yeah.
So that's why it's really nice to have an insurance guru like Marnie, because she can analyze the insurance policies, because unfortunately that does come into play when you look at valuation. How much is this organization worth and what are they willing to pay to keep this out of the news per se? So looking at the insurance policy also comes into valuation, having an insurance guru who can say, oh, this actually does apply because of this. And actually, let me get your umbrella policy. That's why we just love Marnie. And then just having the trial expertise, you know what? You don't want to give my client what he or she deserves. I'll see you in court. And many attorneys don't have that background, and some of them may be too afraid to go to trial.
How many of these cases settle, or how many go to trial? I mean, I'm assuming when you have the evidence that you have and you're walking into some kind of a conference with the other side, that conversation, a lot of it depends on that. But in general, when you have a good case, how many cases ever get to court and how many settle? I know we don't have the exact percentages, but
I always tell my clients 99.9% of our cases settle, but you always have to be ready to be the 0.1.
Exactly.
And I'm assuming that the insurance companies know who will go to court and who will not go to court.
And one thing I will say, I can speak directly to that question. It's a great question, because I was on the defense side for 11 years before I joined our firm. I knew of our firm, obviously. It's the reason why I came here. And I had cases directly adverse. And I actually would put in my reports to my clients, this is Salts Mongoluzzi. Take this case very seriously.
Oh, I love that piece of information.
I truly did, though. And they knew that this was a case.
And that's, again, where picking the right attorney is so important, and having that credibility and having that those resources
right.
to go to distance. Mm-hmm. You talk about statutes of limitations. Okay, now there's a lot of different types of situations. We've heard, obviously, cases where somebody, went to a particular school and all these things, and how does that work? With for example, the difference between, we only have about three or four minutes left, but how does it work when it's an individual case where it's an insurance parking lot situation where somebody dimly lit, all those things, as compared to somebody who went to a particular school that might have gotten molested years ago?
So it's really complicated, and I would say
you got 3 minutes.
It's very complicated, and if you have questions about it, call us. So in the case of like a negligent security case, those are almost always going to be normal statutes. Wouldn't that just fall under a 2-year, right?
Yeah, but the sex abuse statute, it depends on really your age. So if you're a minor, it'll toll, which means it won't start until they hit majority. And then for any type of sex abuse, even if it's a negligence claim, if you're between 18 and 24, the Pennsylvania legislators, not so much as New Jersey, but the Pennsylvania legislators do have an expansion, and I think a very progressive expansion for college-age students who are sexually abused. So it does depend.
It's so complicated. So
definitely call us.
So call us. But a lot of states have done this where they've opened up the statute of limitations for sex abuse because of the Catholic Church, because of these schools that have come out.
The Boy Scouts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just because it happened years ago for you, it doesn't mean you're necessarily counted out, because the states have opened up these statutes.
And we look at cases from all over the country.
Right.
That's right.
If you're in Kentucky, I think they've opened up theirs for like 6 years. So many states have opened them up because of what we figured out.
And that's why I talked about confidentiality and privacy, because people are not calling, haphazardly, just I wonder if this is no. They're nervous. They may or may not have a case, and they hanging it out there can be a very painful.
Anything you tell us, even if you don't sign up with us as attorneys, if you call us just to get information, that initial call with us, you're still entitled to attorney-client privilege. Even if you decide not to go forward with anything with us, that initial intake call, that question, just to ask questions, that's enough on just the initial call. You get attorney-client privilege on that initial call with us. So you don't have to worry that, you know, that information's going to get out somewhere because you didn't sign a contract with us. Doesn't matter. That's all protected.
And there's no out-of-pocket cost.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay, we're coming to the conclusion of the fastest hour in radio. Having said that, is there, organization you talked about? If somebody calls and even if you're not handling their case, organizations that people that can help people, you know, get through the emotional process. Whether to, what should somebody do if they think they have. A situation, or they're going through a situation. Now I'll ask you, Kristen, and we'll roll with this because it could be a criminal case. You were a prosecutor, and of course, obviously it could be a civil case. What's the first thing they should do?
The first thing they do is should trust their gut. I always like to tell people to call law enforcement, but that may not be something that they're comfortable with doing. Trust their gut. Go to someone that they trust. Speak to, maybe it's a clergy member, but if it's a member of the clergy who has sexually abused them, they may not want to go there, right?
Sure.
Or if it's a member of law enforcement, they may not want to report it to the police. So go to someone you trust, speak to someone who you trust and will be able to be supportive to you. And then go from there. And like Liz actually pointed out, call an attorney. See what your options are. If they're a good attorney like the ones here at Saltz Mongoloozy, they'll give you all of your options, not just your civil options, but they'll give you a 360 approach to assist you.
Well, that's great advice. And the contact information here at the firm, SMBB.com?
Yeah,
you got it.
I got it. I've been to the website a couple of times. First of all, I want to thank you for being here today. And I want to really thank you for the work that you do every day on behalf of people who are often, in such bad situations, they don't know if they can move forward. So continued, success and thank you for that. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to the Saltz Mongoloozy Bendesky Hour here on WWDB Talk 860. I want to thank Kristen Fedden, Elizabeth Bailey, and Marnie Berger for being fantastic guests and doing what you do. On behalf of everyone on the panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everyone.